On WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Reese Helmick with your WSLR news headlines for Wednesday, July 9th. Several religious leaders from across the state made their way to the state capitol Tuesday calling for Governor Ron DeSantis to pause executions. Since 1976, no more than 8 people have been executed in a single year in Florida. So far, 7 men have been executed this year, and Florida is on track to break its record of 8 executions in a year. Michael Bell, convicted of killing 2 people about 20 years ago, is set to be executed July 15th with another man, Edward Zarchevsky, slated to be executed July 31st. Since 1976, Florida has executed 113 people, and there are currently 269 inmates waiting on death row. Bradenton has a new police chief. Josh Kramer was sworn in to head the Bradenton Police Department yesterday, replacing Melanie Bevin after a 9-year stint as Bradenton's police chief. Bradenton Mayor Gene Brown, who swore in Kramer, recommended him for the position. Kramer, who resigned as a city councilman, was one of 5 candidates for the post. All candidates were local, with 4 out of the 5 working in the Bradenton Police Department. Former Police Chief Bevin will help her successor settle into his new position before retiring from her 30-year career in law enforcement. If you plan to drive to Siesta Key, plan ahead. The island's main road, Ocean Boulevard, will be closed between Givens Street and Hegel Avenue through July 21st for repaving and a makeover, the Sarasota County Public Works Department announced. The county picked Ajax Paving Industries of North Venice as the contractor. The county expects the company to put up portable changeable message signs about the work and to notify residents about the road closure 1 week in advance. Work had to be stopped due to damage by Hurricanes Helene and Milton, but the project resumed April 28th. Paving was completed on streets off the west end of Beach Road and just west of Siesta Key Village. Completion of this project is anticipated for fall this year. The Sarasota County Parks, Recreation, and Natural Resources Department received the 2025 Conservation Award from the National Association of County Park and Recreation Officials. The award is given out annually to organizations who present exceptional efforts to acquire, restore, and preserve natural conservation areas, as well as create public awareness for conservation initiatives. To raise public interest about its conservation efforts and prompt people to visit the areas, the county has implemented a community education plan using social media and more. This has been Reese Helmick with your WSLR news headlines for Wednesday, July 9th.
This is Tom Walker with the WSLR Peace and Justice Report. I had a caller on the phone. I hope she'll call back in. Maybe we should hang up and give her a chance to call back in. And we're going to be talking today, if we get her to reconnect, with about the immigration situation in Sarasota and in the country. I want to remind you, though, that the views and opinions expressed here by hosts like me, our guests and callers, are their own opinions and not necessarily those of the WSLR, its staff, or its volunteers. So, Leon, I think you ought to, if you got a 5 minutes, I want you to tell us about this radio camp that's going on here and all the kids you got coming in this morning and what they're doing.
We are having a blast next door at Fogartyville. Right now we've got 13 students doing their radio camp, and they're learning how to run the board and making up their own programs and having a blast. Oh, we see a caller calling coming in right now.
Let's try it again. Turn it on.
Yeah.
Hello.
And then we should just be able to hear right through here right now.
Okay, speak up. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah,
good morning.
Good morning. I think we got you now.
All right. Thank you.
Way to go. All right. I'm hearing her really clear over my earphones. Okay. Thank you, Leon, for your help. That's a radio camp for teenagers. We're teaching them how to do radio of all kinds, how to make their own programs, and it's amazing. So
that's wonderful.
So I've already announced our station ID and our And we're saying that, of course, the views of this of me and our guests are our own and not of necessarily of the station. Today, our guest is Maria Lara. Maria is was born in Cuba and is a naturalized American citizen. She received a doctorate of law from Stetson University and has been working in immigration for the past 25 years. She was raised and went to high school in Charlotte County and then left for 15 years but came back. And she was elected recently as the immigration chair of the League of United Latin American Citizens State Board in 2024. She's current president of the League of United Latin American Citizens Charlotte Harbor Council. That's abbreviated LULAC, by the way. And she's also a Rotarian, like me. And she's a member of the Immigration Justice Coalition of Southwest Florida, which I believe is based in the Unitarian Church here. So, what did I leave out, Maria? You've quite the experience.
Thank you. I actually work with clients in immigration law as well, so I have my own company where I do immigration work for immigrants who need assistance through the process. So that's the other thing I do.
Of course you do. I read just the other day that about 16% of the United States population was born in another country. Okay, that's 53 million people. And about 5% of those, or about 14 million, are here without documentation. You could say illegally, you could say without documentation. And I've also read that 60% of the immigrants since 2021 have also been here or entered without documentation, or authorization. So give us an overview, please, from your point of view of the current immigration situation in the United States and in Florida.
Well, thank you for having me here, Tom.
You're welcome.
To speak on this issue. This is so important right now, what's happening in this country. It has been for a long time, but essentially what's happened with immigration is nothing. For the last 25 years, there have been several bills that have been presented to Congress, both chambers. Sometimes it'll pass one chamber, not the other. So essentially our Congress has not passed any legislation on immigration, substantive legislation. To provide a means or mechanism by which people who have in the past come in through the border or various other ways, ports of entries with visas and overstayed, to document. So that's the reason they're undocumented. It's not because they don't want to be undocumented. It's because they have not been able to be provided a process.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially the last substantive bill on immigration is what's called the LIFE Act. It was passed in 2000 and essentially was addressing the issue of people who have come in or immigrants have come in through the border essentially and could not process in this country. They still cannot process in this country, but at that time they provided a mechanism by which people could pay a penalty and they could, if they were otherwise eligible for a residency, either as a married to an American citizen or had a parent or child over 21 that could petition for them. It was an immediate process for them if they paid a penalty, which they were willing and happy to do, to be able to process here in this country and become residents. Unfortunately, that stopped in 2001, April of 2001, and since then that's not been something that's been available to them. So we have people who've been here for a significant period of years, 20, 25 years. They have families here. They have older children here, over 21. Sometimes they have grandchildren. They have businesses. And so they're part of our system society, work-wise, paying, you know, sales taxes and other types of taxes, business-wise and, education-wise, various different ways. They're part of our community, but they cannot get documents. They have not been able to become documented. And so that's created a crisis now, because people aren't the understanding these people are all illegal and they should be thrown out of the country. Unfortunately, they are part of the rubric of this country.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do we do with that? Essentially, the Congress needs to do something, but in this particular climate, I don't think that's going to happen in any kind of positive way for people to be able to process. Immigration reform has been in the works, as I said, for over 25 years, and it hasn't happened under, Democratic, presidents and Congresses. So the only solution is a comprehensive solution, and no one has seemed to be able to touch that. So right now, yes, we probably have, I believe in your statistics, 14 million, maybe more people who have, no documentation. There's a question of whether or not they're criminals. They haven't violated any criminal laws. We're not talking about those people. People who have no documents have come in, either to the country without papers, so they have violated an immigration statute, and or they've overstayed their visas, again violating an immigration statute. So they are, you might say, unlawfully here, but they're not criminals. So I just want to make that clear.
Of course. Now, recently ICE has been, as you know, beefed up. They've asked for a huge increase in the budget for ICE, making it one of the largest government agencies. They've been arresting immigrants from Venezuela for alleged gang affiliations, and there are students who have been arrested because of even those who have green cards, and we'll talk about what that means, have been arrested if they were part of a pro-Palestinian protest. So I'd say we're looking at a huge increase in the budget and the activity of the ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and a new detention system where they just, of course, as you know, just built the alligator Alcatraz, so to speak, in the Everglades. What do you anticipate, and what help is there for those people who are there? I mean, do they have access to attorneys? How does it work once you get picked up? And we'll talk about how to avoid that and some other advice from your organizations. But anyway, what do people do when they're picked up, and what precautions should they take before they're picked up if they might be?
Well, first, let me address the issue of whether or not they have access to attorneys and what they can do when they're in the system, right? They've been detained. I work with individuals all the time, and through my organizations and my company, and essentially, theoretically, yes, they do have the right to counsel. Unfortunately, there is a lot of discretion and communication control on the part of ICE, and once the individual is detained, then it becomes an issue of communication with counsel and the opportunity to represent these individuals. So I said theoretically that is available to them. But in my particular experience, we have run up against situations where we cannot get communications with an individual or an individual deportation officer or the detention center. So essentially not being able to access them or them be able to access us, then it creates an issue of, well, do they really have the right to counsel in a realistic way?
Right.
So that's been a real problem. I experienced that personally. And, essentially turning to the courts in some cases to be able to address that directly with the courts, the immigration courts. They have been a little bit more, willing to at least acknowledge the right to counsel and the presence of counsel and address the issues that are being presented to them. at some point. But, you know, when they get, you know, these individuals detained, they, you know, they're desperate. Obviously, their families are left behind. They don't know what's going on, what their rights are. Some of them don't speak the language, unfortunately, so that creates an issue as well. So, I think there has to be more scrutiny paid to the detention process, because I think that they're essentially left to linger there, and I don't, you know, to what extent that they're able to have access to attorneys or their family members on the outside. It's very not negligible.
Well, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think there's no limit to where, to how long they can be held, and there's no specifications as to where. And I've heard that the ICE moves people from center to center as maybe part of a tactic to keep them isolated or away from their attorneys, or remote from their attorneys if they have one. So does that sound right? No limit to the detention?
There is no limit to the detention. Some years back, the U.S. Supreme Court was addressed this issue. Initially, they said that there would be a 6-month period of, that was many years ago. And then ultimately, they reversed themselves and said, well, we can't really set a time limit because of the case-by-case basis. So essentially, there is no limit to their length of detention. A lot of times, they get that they, I have experience where they ask the detainees to sign documents for their own deportation, and when they do not do so, they will remain detained.
Right.
And so, yes, they do move them from facility to facility and far away from their families. Many of the people that I'm dealing with right now have been taken to El Paso. They've been moved to other locations. Sometimes you cannot locate them because the locator system just gives a zip code. It doesn't tell you what facility they're at.
Wow.
So
wow.
That is a huge problem with respect to access to representation and to their families. That is a thing. It is a thing. Yeah.
So you cannot put in, if you know somebody has been detained, you cannot ask some official and to give them that name. You cannot find out exactly where they are or contact them. That's amazing.
I mean, to a certain extent you can, but, you know, like I said, sometimes they'll put on the locator for the place where they're housed. I've had situations where they contact the facility and they don't acknowledge they're there.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, that's, and or they don't put the actual facility where they're at. You know, their statement is that they're not where they're ultimately to be detained, but oftentimes they are, but they just don't give the location. And they do get transported from place to place. And like these individuals are from Florida. Their cases are like in Orlando Immigration Court, Miami Immigration Court, but yet they're being taken to El Paso, Texas, and other places close to that. So there's no real indication why that is. You know, access is an issue. I know they've just created this new detention center here in Florida.
That's right.
And so their intention is to detain more people and house more people by doing so. Mm. And, you know, before it was certain individuals, the individuals at risk were prioritized as criminals. Criminals were always at risk of deportation, and that was the priority, to detain and deport criminals. It's been the priority for, I don't know, over 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
But more recently, that's been expanded to people who don't have documents.
Right.
And so I think the target is that, as well as the last people who have entered within the last 4 years or the past administration. And so a lot of people who were on humanitarian parole from certain countries that was essentially created during the Biden administration, they are now, they've lost their status, essentially. So even though they came documented, they've now lost their status because the current administration has terminated parole effective April of 2025. So So essentially they're here without, you know, and they've been undocumented, let me put it that way. So, and then TPS is the other issue. You know, a lot of Venezuelans who have TPS are now, you know, without documentation.
What was that, TPS?
So
temporary protective status?
Yes, temporary protective status. And essentially they had documentation, but that's been taken away from them. So it's kind of like a little bit of a reverse process.
So if you're from, with that status, if you're from Venezuela, Haiti, Ukraine, Afghanistan, Nepal, Cameroon, Nicaragua, Honduras, you're likely to be in trouble. So,
in Nicaragua, Cubans, Haitians, Venezuelans, and others you mentioned, that came in on humanitarian parole, they are, they no longer have that status. I know of an individual who was detained, because he was accompanying someone to another person, immigrant to an ICE reporting, and he was detained. He doesn't have any criminal history whatsoever. He had, humanitarian parole, Cuban humanitarian parole, but that was terminated in April. So in May, he was detained, and has been in detention ever since. He came with documents, and essentially his parole was available until November of this year, but that was terminated. He has a pending adjustment case with the agency, but I guess he would have to process that through, you know, while in detention, which is kind of a little bit, difficult, if not almost impossible. I'm not sure how that works. He cannot be released because he's considered an arriving alien, and the courts cannot. They have no authority to release arriving aliens.
We're talking to Maria Lara of the United Latin American Citizens. That's LULAC, L-U-L-A-C, and also of the Immigration Justice Coalition. You know, in my opinion, of course, everybody here in the country is an immigrant, or their ancestors were. So, and immigrants built our country, as you know. I don't know why we've all of a sudden turned against, made it so hard for them. What about the birthright citizenship? In other words, people. Now, this is a side issue, but people who were born here, that even that's in question in the Trump administration. Is there anything recent happening with that? The Constitution says you're a citizen if you're born here.
Yeah, the Constitution is very clear. It's all persons born in the United States or its territories, and all persons naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States. So that was a decision the Congress made way back when. And it's an amendment to the Constitution. It's very clear on its face. It's not at all equivocal in its writing. So if you do a strict interpretation, it would be that they are citizens of, born right here, are citizens of the United States. We had filed the ACLU, LULAC joined ACLU in fighting the executive order, which essentially has taken away citizenship, birthright citizenship to those children that were born of parents who are not documented. That's essentially what it said, or have overstayed their visa.
Wow.
So that's essentially what the executive order says. But it's clearly, I mean, to anyone who I would say has a legal background and has experience with the Constitution would say that's unconstitutional. The courts and the lower courts, some of the district courts had enjoined the executive order on that issue, but the Supreme Court recently has stayed or has indicated that injunctions or stays by the lower courts of any executive orders are not authorized or permitted. So what's happened is now those courts that enjoined the application of that law, which we don't really know how that's going to work, because citizenship has, you know, addresses a lot of things like health care, education, you know, a lot of different things. And so the Supreme Court said that they have to wait for the lower courts to run the legal process. That's where we are with that.
What are you advising people now? I know there was an advice recently to try to request hearings that are virtual over the computer, and so that you don't put yourself at a place where you might be picked up. Is that good advice? And can people do that?
Yes. Our coalition and myself another member, Matthew Montalban, we set out a press release on behalf of Immigration Justice Coalition, which are based out of UU, Sarasota, indicating exactly that individuals can request hearings, virtual hearings, in lieu of appearance or in advance of appearance. They have to do it within 15 days prior to their hearing, at least 15 days. They should do that. And they can, if they have counsel, that would be best for counsel request that. But if not, individually, they can request the courts. To what extent the courts will honor individual requests, we do not know. Mm. But it's certainly safer than having to appear in court and being faced with potential detention. There is a process in the courts. I don't want to get complicated here, but typically the master hearing, which is the first or second hearing, the courts will ask if you will admit to the factual allegations on the charges. Typically there are, in the great majority of the cases, they are correct. So you have to admit, once those are admitted, you are determined to be removable under the statutes, typically, because these are typically people who are undocumented, so they are subject to removal. So that creates a concern that once there is a preliminary determination of removability, that the individuals will be detained pending their ability to present a basis for release. And that really restricts their opportunity to establish a basis for relief in the court. So it's kind of like defense, you know, your defensive position is kind of like cut at the knees, because you have, you know, once your client is in detention, it's very difficult to represent a client.
So what do you do then? Just hide? Just don't show up? What do you do? I know you can't advise somebody not to show up, but what should a person do?
I really believe that we should follow the law, and there's processes here that you know, of our country that we have, that I think we should honor these processes.
Sure.
But at the same time, individuals shouldn't be put in a position where they're having they're having their liberty taken without due process or representation. That's also part of our system of laws and government in our Constitution. So it's kind of like a little bit of a gray area, and it's a case-by-case basis. But I think overall, I think, you know, you do have to meet the requirements of the law, but at the same time, I don't think you should put yourself in the position where your liberty is going to be taken from you. So as far as the court situation is concerned, more specifically, I would urge them to request that the hearing be virtual.
Okay.
There is no reason why the courts cannot grant that or should not grant that, because it's actually in their best interest. The courts for a long time, not just in this situation, have been doing virtual hearings because there's such a volume of cases that they cannot handle those cases in person.
Mm-hmm.
And also immigration is federal, so their attorneys are not necessarily from that particular location or state at all. So it creates a situation where it's a win for the courts, and it's a win for the attorneys and the individuals, because of time, mm-hmm. in the interest of time and efficiency. So it's not a situation that's happening now. It's been going on. The courts have moved to that, and I think that if you request that within a reasonable period of time, the courts should provide that as an opportunity. You know, if they do not, I mean, I would have to leave it to the individual to decide in their particular case what they should or should not do. If they can't seek counsel, I would urge them to seek counsel or an agency that can provide them with some sort of representation in court. The courts, immigration courts, typically do not entertain allegations or not allegations, but argument or from individuals that are not represented. They don't like to do that. They prefer that the individuals be represented. Oftentimes, they will continue cases so that individual can obtain representation. To what extent that has changed or will change, we do not know. But certainly, if you don't have counsel, maybe request that you have some additional time to request counsel, and in the interim, a virtual hearing. Mm-hmm. That seems reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that somebody can, you know, help them articulate. They can articulate to the courts if they don't have counsel.
Well, we're talking to Maria Lara of LULAC, United Latin American Citizens, and also of the Immigration Justice Coalition here at the UU Church in Sarasota. So we're talking about, you mentioned representation, attorneys, immigration attorneys. How easy is that to get, and how many people have taken that step? Is that difficult to do? How would you go about it?
In my particular situation, a lot of people have approached me and my colleagues to essentially be on standby to assist if representation is needed.
Okay.
And, you know, we're willing to do so because we want to be able for these persons to have representation, right?
Okay.
Me personally, we do not charge individuals
That's
to do
great.
That.
Great.
If something, you know, if a case occurs, and then petitions or motions have to be filed, a request for bond, things like that, then we all charge for that process, whatever that process is. But we, in advance, you know, we're willing to get their information, and if they contact us, you know, we're here to assist, you know. I think that they maybe should approach other attorneys to do, you know, something to that extent. To what extent there are organizations out there, no Lutheran Services has assisted individuals. There's a lot of other nonprofit agencies. If they're not able to afford an attorney, they might be able to seek some sort of assistance that way. I think that they're really tapped resource-wise, but, you know, I think that's something they should look into. I think it's wise if you are in a take measures for prevention, if you can,
sure.
You know, by trying to seek counsel in advance, I think that's probably wise.
There's other things in this. Well, I'm going to be talking about a document that your organization has published called El Escudo. I don't know if I pronounced that right, but it means the shield, right, in Spanish. And it's a long 66-page, which I read, a document about what to do, how to do it, what precautions to take. And I posted a link to it in our announcement on the front page of WSLR. If you click on our talk about immigration, and it'll take you to a write-up, which includes the link to that document, which is an excellent document. One of the things from it, it reminds you of your rights. And maybe you could speak to that really quickly. If you are approached by an ICE agent, you have the right to remain silent and so forth, speak to an attorney. Go over some of those rights, our cautions or things people should be aware of and do if they're approached or if someone knocks on the door and says they have a warrant. What should they do?
There's a little bit of that is an excellent document, by the way. Thank you for referring to that. El Escudo, it means the shield. That is correct. And the shield is essentially what it says, to shield yourself from loss of liberty, essentially,
right.
Without where your rights are being essentially trying, you know, they're trying to take away the rights of an individual in the context of, you know, their right to liberty. So in this country we have, in the criminal context, the Miranda warnings. A Miranda is essentially warnings that police officers have to provide to detainees before they can essentially take them in to detention. And this is in the immigration context, Miranda is not directly in effect, but there are rights that all individuals have, all persons in the United States, including the so-called aliens, as they're called, immigrants, and that is the right, the right to remain silent. You do not have to provide any information to any officer unless you choose to. To what extent they will use that against you, then that's an issue, you know, that we need to address as a society. I know of a situation in this particular case, to talk about this individual that was picked up while he was accompanying someone for ICE reporting. The officer asked his name. He gave his name. They put his name in the system, and they realized that he was an intern on humanitarian parole, that was no longer in place because of the administration's executive order, and therefore they detained him. The officer's comment to the family was that he did not have to give him his name.
That's right. You have
so
the right.
That's the case.
You have the right to remain silent, right? Yeah.
Exactly. So in that particular case, he gave his name. He didn't feel he was violating anything, doing anything wrong, which he really truly wasn't. But he gave his name, and then he showed up in their system as somebody who had wasn't on the parole status, but that had been terminated. So you do have the right to remain silent. You do have the right to seek counsel, to speak to an attorney. It's not the same type of rights that are in the criminal context where they have. You have the right to be provided an attorney if you can afford one. That does not apply in the immigration context.
Right.
You have to provide your own counsel, but you do have the right to seek and obtain counsel on representation. You have the right in certain circumstances to be bonded, to post bond. And it's very limited in the immigration context, but that still exists. You have the right to have a hearing before the courts unless you are an expedited removal has been, you have been removed in the past, and then they can do expedited removal.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's not the case, you have the right to appear in court and have the court decide your case. So it's the right to due process. So all these things are things that apply in the immigration context, and persons need to know that because a lot of times they're intimidated. They don't know, you know, what to do or say. They feel that if they say something that they will not be detained. That's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
That is not the case.
Well, there are some advice. There's some advice if someone shows up at your door. The advice is don't open the door. If they say they have a warrant, they should slide it under the door. It should have your name on it and be signed by a judge, so forth, so forth. Lots of details here in this document. Like I said, 66 pages of advice, half of it in Spanish. And I think if I was undocumented in this country, I think I would read it and memorize it. Also, there are things about arranging for a guardian for in case you're detained for your children, so forth, so forth. What other advice do you give people, or should we let people know about in this instance?
Yes, the warrant issue is really important, and a lot of people don't understand that. And we're trying to get out the word, and I think maybe the document is a little too lengthy and so we have certain smaller. We refer them to smaller snippets of one-page information of things that they can do. They do not have to answer the door. The red cards, yeah.
Yeah.
There are little cards, and then that gives them an indicator of what their rights are and what they can and cannot do. They do not have to answer the door. If someone is trying to execute a warrant, law enforcement or ICE, they have to have a judicial warrant in order to enter a residence and execute that warrant or serve the warrant. So these so-called warrants from immigration, they're administrative warrants in the sense that they're signed by an ICE officer. They are not signed by, they're not presented to a judge, and they're not signed by a judge.
Oh.
So they're not the kind of warrants that permit a law enforcement to go into someone's house.
Okay.
To arrest them. So that's the reason they don't have to answer the door. So they, even if they give them the warrant through the door, if it's not a judicial warrant, they do not have the right to enter the home to arrest the person if they're there.
Okay.
So, that's very different from a judicial warrant. If there's a judicial warrant by a judge, the officer knock on the door, it's knock and announce, and then they can enter through whatever means possible to execute that warrant.
Okay, so you should ask that this warrant, whatever kind it is, be slipped under the door so you'll know, I guess, right? Is that there?
I personally would say don't answer the door, don't ask anything.
Right, gotcha.
If they have a judicial warrant, they're going to execute it, right?
Right.
At the way that they can, and they should.
Otherwise, now, just be quiet, I guess, right?
So. I don't see why you would have to answer the door.
I got it.
You know, that's, you know, it's because even if it's an administrative warrant, even if it has your name on it, that does not give them the right to enter into your home.
How can you tell whether it's an administrative warrant or a judicial warrant? How do you tell the difference?
Well, the difference is one is signed by a judge. It can be federal judges, yes, district court judges. So, but it's signed by a judge, or a judicial officer.
Okay.
So that's the difference. We put samples of the administrative warrants. The administrative warrant, what it is called a notice to appear.
Okay.
Abbreviated, we call it the NTAs, but, on the bottom of the NTA, it shows it has to be served on the individual. So that is their intention, right? So they sign this warrant so that charging document can be served on the person. And that's what they're called administrative warrants.
Okay.
And I can send you a sample of one, but that's, I think we may have some on our website, but there is a big difference between the two.
Okay.
So your
best advice so far is don't answer the door or have a doorbell camera so you know who it is or what.
Exactly. There's no reason. If they're going to execute a judicial warrant, they're going to break through
the
door.
Yeah.
And it is what it is, you know. The judicial warrants would be in the context of crime, right? If there's a crime committed or a suspicion of a crime, then the law enforcement goes to a judge, and if they have to establish probable cause, and if they establish probable cause to the judge will sign a judicial warrant. That's the difference between a judicial warrant and an administrative warrant. For a judicial warrant, there has been a predetermination of probable cause, which
uh-huh.
is what the Constitution requires before you intrude into someone's home.
Gotcha. Now, another thing, good advice, I guess, for anybody is careful driving. Lulu Martinez was a 22-year-old arrested for driving without a valid license and handed over to ICE, and she's in Raymondville, Texas. She's moved several times. Like I said, that's a tactic. What do we hear about her case or similar cases? Anything, is there anything happening or any improvement in their positions or?
I think the traffic stop is the most vulnerable situation for immigrants right now. Because my understanding, in Florida specifically, the sheriffs have been deputized and some of the city police departments. So what that does is that they're now able to act as ICE officers as far as looking the individuals up on the ICE system, Department of Homeland Security check system. And to see if there's a detainer, to see if there's any kind of notice to appear, like in the charging documents
mm-hmm.
that they have, and also to inquire, if they have a license or not have a license. They have to have a license, obviously,
yeah.
in order to drive.
Right.
So my recommendation is do not drive if you do not have a license. I know that's easier said than done, but You know, there are other things that you might be able to do. You know, someone else drive you.
Uber, whatever, you know, if you can afford it. Yeah.
Uber, whatever. Where you know, some organizations are
carpooling,
drive, and carpooling and things like that, or mass transportation if you're in that situation. But traffic stops are very vulnerable because there is a reduced focus on the need for probable cause. Just a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity or any kind of, in this context, it would be activity that would cause them to believe you're undocumented. That's sufficient. So that is a situation where I would say be very, very careful about driving. If you don't have a license, absolutely do not drive.
You're an attorney. Let me ask you a question. If the officers ask for a password to your electronic device, a phone, do you have to give it to them or not?
You don't have to answer the officer unless,
oh,
you know, once you're if you're arrested, then they take your devices, right? But you have the right to remain silent. So
right.
In my opinion is no, you don't have to.
Right. I would say take away facial recognition, and because that they could hold it in front of your face
and open
your phone. Take away facial recognition and also use a 6-digit code instead of 4, and you'll be okay probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they can seize your phone, and then they may be able to obtain the information that way. But that's, you know, that's, again, that's could be potentially a violation of your Fourth Amendment rights to search and seizure. So, you know, you personally don't have to volunteer any information.
Yeah.
You know, that's just my recommendation. So.
Okay, so again, we're talking worst case. Maybe you're stopped and maybe you're detained. And let's say you haven't arranged for an attorney yet. What number should you call to get help from somebody like your organizations, somebody to help you find a legal representative? But what number should people call to once they're detained?
You know, that is an excellent question. We should have like a special number for organizations, like they have 411 and 911.
Exactly.
And all these things.
Sure.
And so that raises the question for our organization. We're going to be going to national convention in August in Los Angeles, it's New York, it's California. But I think that's something that we should develop because I think that people need quick access and
wonderful.
You know, something simple.
Yeah.
So thank you for that, Tom. That's a wonderful suggestion.
Well,
I'm going to bring
national,
it up to them.
You know, there's a national mental crisis hotline. There's a national rape. There's all sorts of national hotlines. Why shouldn't there be one for a poor immigrant who just has not thought ahead enough to have any kind of help available? That's a great idea.
It's an excellent idea. There's a lot of organizations that put out their numbers, but they're lost in the, you know, to people who don't have access to a lot of things and there's so many that they're diluted, you know, and then sometimes you call in these numbers and there's no person manning.
Right, you have to leave a message.
Exactly. So, yeah, so you have an excellent, excellent point. That's a wonderful thing. I think we need to absolutely develop something like that.
As soon as possible.
As soon as possible. I'm bringing it up. Our convention is August, first week in August, and I'm bringing that up. And I'm going to mention you by name.
Mention WSLR.
WSLR, this is the way to go. Tom said it, and I think
Oh,
he's
I
right.
hope you do that. That would be so much help. So helpful. My goodness. All these people all of a sudden needing help. And we can't all be geniuses and have arranged for an attorney on speed dial. It's just not practical. So
it's not practical. Yeah. Yes, you're right.
Wow.
Also, I wanted to address a question that you raised or somebody raised before about guardianship for children.
Yes.
Children, what are you doing with their children?
Yes.
We did have an individual that came to our office. I was really impressed with him because he is perfect, you know, he's perfectly documented, you know, right now wife and he has two children and their minors are early middle school age, early teens.
Uh-huh.
And he came, approached us to do a power of attorney for his children to a very close family friend. In case anything happens with them. And I thought, wow, that is so impressive that you're so vigilant and, you know, about your kids.
That's in that document. The shield is how to do that and advice to do that.
Yes. That's a good thing to do. It's hard. It's very heart-wrenching to do that, you know, but at the same time, it's a good thing to do because, you know, as parents, we want our children to be protected. So, it's a good thing to do.
Yeah. And memorize that number, of course, for your attorney or the new hotline we're going to get for nationwide problems.
That's right.
Memorize that thing. You know, I know I can memorize one telephone. I'm getting old, but I can memorize one number.
We have to find out what number 11 is still available.
Or it could even be a really easy to remember 7-digit number, but it's got to be promoted and on all the literature. And then you got to maintain it 24 hours a day. You don't know when these people stop you on the street or in a traffic situation or at your home. We got about 10 more minutes. What else have we not covered? What do you want to talk about besides this?
I want to say that I just want to alert your listening public that there have been periods of immigration in this country, not just now, where there has been a lot of strife and a lot of pushback against immigrants. As we know, it happened, you know, with the Irish, with the Italians,
yes,
with the Jews,
yes,
with the Chinese, with, you know, so many over time. And Ellis Island was there as a buffer, essentially, and many of those people, almost all of those people that came to Ellis Island, they didn't come with documents.
That's right.
They didn't have visas to enter.
Of course. Ellis Island, they just showed up, right?
They showed up in boats, and then the immigration was there to process them, right? So they weren't, that was that situation at that time, but they weren't coming in with documents. So, you know, we need to be vigilant of the fact that it's the same people. We are all, like you said, we're all immigrants here. Some, you know, earlier, some later, but, you know, to turn against someone because they are an immigrant seems to fly in the face of your own past and your own struggles that your ancestors went through or
exactly.
Your grandparents
sure.
Went through. There's always been some sort of xenophobia with respect to immigration. But a lot of people need to, you know, I think they need to understand that we are a melting pot country and we are the better for all the differences that we have culturally. That gives our country a very unique situation and a multi-flavored kind of way.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, our neighbors, you know, our friends, our family, you know, fast family, you know, we're all immigrants of some sort or another. We, you know, maybe initially started speaking, you know, came in, they spoke different languages. Ultimately, these are assimilated. As you can see, my first language is Spanish, but I speak very fluent English. So over time, you know, we assimilate, we learn the language. I think there's just, I think it's the concern is it's volume. But we're such a vast country. There's so much land here, and I think that you know it's a very small way of thinking when you're trying to exclude people that are giving your country so much benefit. Immigrants statistically are not criminals, and they improve our society by
they pay taxes,
work,
they pay social
their work,
security.
And their work, they have hard, you know, strong work ethics because they want to improve their lives, the lives of their children, and so they tend to be more law abiding because they don't want to have any, you know, any concerns. They don't feel entitled to anything. So, you know, it's they're very thankful for being in this country, so they try to do more. And I think statistics show that. So I think people need to know that they're not your enemy. And they all they want is to be able to become legal and process and, you know, work and help their children and improve their lives and improve their lives in their community. Many of them pay back to the community. They do a lot of services for the community in various different ways. Many of them are people of faith.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, our pastors are being assaulted who may or may not have documentation,
whoa,
which is sad, but that's the case because, as I said, for 25 years, there's been no way for people to process, come in through certain ways, and, you know, they were permitted to enter.
Right.
And they've
right.
been permitted to be here and to live and to work. So, you know, what do we do now? We need to, for the last one, we have not really addressed immigration in any kind of realistic
that's
way.
True. That's true. And there have been programs for farm laborers that have been ignored, or it's a mess. And a lot of these people, like you say, just want to live a normal life and help us out, especially in agriculture and meat packing and things like that. I don't understand this nativist attitude of people where, you know, we don't want foreigners. We're all foreigners. Yeah. So,
That's right. That's right. And I remember when my family first came here, I felt like really well received. My family, we felt like we really came with nothing, and just regular people helped us out. And so I think that the majority of Americans feel that way. I think that this whole demonization of immigrants, it's coming from a certain sector.
Ooh.
And it's just unfortunately has spilled over and taken over our way of thinking in many ways, in many areas. But I think for the most part, the people of this country are wonderful people, and they're very welcoming people. And so I think it's unfortunate that it's some sort of a bad mark has been put on immigrants through this particular administration. So.
Maybe we should try to get together in person and meet more of these people, because I know for a fact that most of them are kind and generous people. You know, learning the language, of course, is a struggle for the older people. I would suggest learning some English, of course, as we should learn a little Spanish. We're talking to Maria Lara of the United Latin American Citizens, ULAC, and the Immigration Justice Coalition of Southwest Florida, which is at the UU Church. Anything new planned out there at the UU Church in Sarasota?
Yes, and I am awful at dates and things. So we have some things planned coming up on the issue of immigration.
Uh-huh.
But I am so reticent to give you information without my script here, because as I said, that's not my my good area. I wish our fearless leader Maria Roballo, she were here, she would be able to tell you all that. But come August and September, we are going to be doing some active things
here in Sarasota, some local things
in Sarasota. Yes, it's the Unitarian Universalist Church on Sarasota. They're on Fruitville Road, and you can look us up. We have, Immigration Justice Committee has a section on the website that it will have the events and things that we're going to be doing.
Yeah.
We have been participating in some rallies on immigration with respect to this new detention center and some other.
Yes, terrific.
Some other rallies that have been promoted locally. And we will continue to do that. We've reached out to the Mockley Farm Workers organizations, and they've come out and presented to us. We've gone out there to visit them. We are forming it's a coalition essentially of different organizations. So we are joining and collaborating, the word, with other organizations and faith-based organizations such as, you know, Jewish Federation, the Lutheran churches and Methodists and some of the other faith-based organizations, okay, as well as LULAC and other civic, okay, organizations.
Okay. Yeah. Maria Laura, go to the Unitarian UU Church website in Sarasota. You'll find out about the Justice Coalition.